From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm your host, Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up on the program, Ruby Rayner of the River Reporter has been looking into the shutdown of the Delaware Aqueduct. She has the latest on that for us, including a lot of details and the concerns that some local leaders have about an increased risk of flooding for river communities. That's coming up later in the program. Right now, however, it is time to get into tonight's main presentation. Election coverage on Radio Catskill continues now with our series of extended interviews with the candidates, and we are about to hear from the second of two candidates running to represent New York's 19th Congressional District. New York 19 stretches from Tompkins County in the west all the way to Columbia County east of the Hudson, and in it, there's parts of the Catskills, Hudson Valley, Southern Tier, and Finger Lake regions. Josh Riley is challenging incumbent Representative Mark Molinaro in New York's 19th. This is the second time that these two have faced off a congressional race, and the seat that they are vying for is among the most competitive districts in the nation. Folks across the country are keeping an eye on New York's 19th, as it's one of four New York seats that flipped 2 years ago, giving Republicans a narrow majority in the House. Patricio Rubio spoke to Josh Riley last week.
You're facing the Republican Mark Molinaro. You ran against him in 2022. It was a really narrow race there, a really close race there. Let's talk about what are some of the main differences between this year's campaign and 2022.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of differences. I mean, we went through a pretty chaotic redistricting process here in New York in 2022, late primaries, a whole host of challenges. But I'll tell you, the biggest difference from 2022 to 2024 is that my opponent now has a voting record. And he can say a lot of things, and he says a lot of things. Most of them are not true. But we can look at his voting record and see where he actually stands on things. So, for example, during the 2022 campaign, right after the Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade, my opponent made a whole bunch of promises about his position with respect to abortion access and reproductive rights. And then he went to Washington and he voted 13 times to restrict women's ability to get abortion services. So he now has to own that record. He said a whole lot of things about his commitments to lowering costs and securing the border and doing a whole host of other things. But I think most of your listeners can ask themselves, what has he actually delivered for you in terms of those issues? And we see a voting record where he opposed a bipartisan plan to secure the border. We see him taking hundreds of thousands of dollars in corporate back checks and then turning around and voting to do what's best for their bottom line instead of ours. And so that voting record is the biggest difference from last time to this time.
What would you say is the most pressing issues facing the 19th Congressional District today?
I mean, there's a lot of issues that I'm hearing about on the campaign trail, but one that I hear in particular in Sullivan County and across the district is we have to rebuild the middle class in this country. Right now, we are in the midst of an affordability crisis. I remember when I was growing up and we used to, at the end of the school year, we'd put our school clothes on layaway for the next school year. And every week we would go down to Kmart and make the payments. It sure as anything, when the next school year came around, our school clothes were ready. I know what those conversations are like sitting at the kitchen table and trying to make sure you have enough money for the utilities and enough money for the school clothes. And you'd like to save up a little bit for a family vacation. And right now, a dollar just doesn't go as far as it needs to for so many families. And so we've got to bring down costs. I think we start doing that by fixing our terribly corrupt campaign finance system. Right now, you have a situation where somebody like my opponent takes hundreds of thousands of dollars in corporate PAC checks. And then when the votes come to Congress about stopping the price gouging, he votes for the special interests and not for us. We've also got to create a whole bunch of new jobs and economic opportunities across the region. I grew up in a blue collar factory town where we lost thousands of jobs when the plants closed down. And we got to start bringing back really good manufacturing jobs, start making things in America again. People should be able to earn a place in the middle class by punching a clock and working with their hands and not have to go get a college degree.
One of the things that is affecting the Sullivan Catskills in our region here is housing. Housing affordability is a major concern. So there's a lot of development going on. A lot of folks, especially even before the pandemic, but mainly after the pandemic, folks are coming up from the city living here in the Catskills, enjoying the area. What could you do to sort of address the housing crisis in this district? Once you get elected.
Yeah, well, I think it's great that so many people from all over the country have discovered how beautiful and wonderful upstate New York is. But I also think it creates a lot of challenges with respect to the housing crisis. And so there's a couple of things that I would like to see Congress do, a couple of things that are part of my plan to bring down the cost of housing. One of them is that we're currently in a situation where you have these hedge funds and private equity backed firms on Wall Street running around gobbling up single family homes and then jacking up the rents and jacking up the prices on them. And the way I see housing is it's something that we should be looking at as a basic necessity. We should be looking at housing as the way to get a roof over the head of families and not something that Wall Street is using to rip people off. And so I want to ban Wall Street from buying single family homes across upstate New York. Those homes should be homes for families, not profit centers for Wall Street. That's one thing. And then the other thing, piece of this is, look, we just don't have enough housing stock. This is a basic supply and demand problem in a lot of ways. We don't have enough housing stock. And to me, the solution to that is build more housing stock. And I would like to see us make a significant investments in building new affordable housing. And when I talk about affordable housing, I mean not just affordable housing for low-income folks, but also for the middle class. It's so hard right now for so many families to make that down payment and earn and get a place, middle-class families to get a house. So we should build more housing stock. We should do it using our local labor unions, our local trades, so that it's good wages and good benefits that are staying in the community. And we should do it in a way that uses the best environmental standards so that we're also fighting climate change in the process.
Now, let's turn our eyes to the opioid crisis, fentanyl trafficking. It's a major concern across the country. And right here in Sullivan County, we were listed the highest overdose rates outside of New York City. We were recently designated the HIDA designation of a high trafficking area. What can you do and what policies can you support to address this issue in the New York's 19th district here?
Yeah, look, we have seen this across upstate New York. There's a lot of suffering because of it and way too many tragedies. On my block or in my neighborhood where I grew up, we lost a whole bunch of jobs. And when you take economic opportunities out of a community, you end up seeing the poverty rates go up. You end up seeing the opioid epidemic ripped through. One of my friends who lived down, I lived on one corner of the street. He lived over on the other corner. He was killed because of the opioid epidemic. A classmate of mine from high school, two blocks behind where I grew up, was killed because of the opioid epidemic. One of my best friend's moms was killed because of the opioid epidemic. So this hits close to home, and it's tragic, and it's got to stop. So we have for far too long in this country and in upstate New York underinvested in addiction services and mental health services and a whole host of other things that folks need to fight addiction. And we have to make the investments to make sure people have the beds that they need. I mean, one of the things I hear about so often from law enforcement is that they are so often responding to incidents where it's not necessarily criminal activity that they're responding to. It's a mental health crisis, or it's the consequences of addiction from somebody who wasn't able to get the services they need. And so one of the things I would like to see us do as a country is provide more funding for law enforcement and more funding for our justice system so that people who are in crisis are able to get access to the services they need.
Another key issue for our voters here is the environment. We live in the Sullivan Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania area. It's known as home of Woodstock Festival. A lot of folks come up here to enjoy the rivers and lakes that we have. What are some of the policies you would either support or introduce to help further protect the environment in our 19th district?
Yeah, well, I'm really proud to be the candidate in this race who is endorsed by the League of Conservation Voters. I'm really proud to be the candidate in this race who's endorsed by the Sierra Club, really proud to be endorsed in this race by the Natural Resources Defense Council, which, as you know, has very deep roots in Sullivan County. I'm the pro-environment candidate in this race. My opponent, you look at his voting record, he's voted to open up. One of the votes he took was on an amendment where the question was whether to allow drilling in the Delaware River Basin, and he voted the wrong way on that. He's taken a whole bunch of money from the fossil fuel industry. And so I don't think it's a surprise that he's been spending a lot of his time giving away subsidies and tax cuts to big oil, while at the same time cutting investments that we need in clean energy manufacturing across upstate New York. I see the threat of climate change as the existential threat facing our planet. I have two little kids, and a big part of the reason why I'm running for Congress is because I want them to grow up on a planet that's habitable. I also see it, because I see it as a crisis, I also see it as a huge economic opportunity for us to rebuild the middle class across upstate New York. It's what we've always done here. I mean, I'm really proud of our manufacturing roots in upstate New York and neighborhoods like the one that I grew up in. And we are as well positioned as any community in the world to build the things the world needs to take on this challenge, to rise to this moment and to meet this moment. So I have a vision of the economy across upstate New York in the future as the place where we're making the solar panels that the world needs to get solar power, making the batteries we need to save the sun when it's not shining and the wind when it's not blowing. That's the vision. We build the things we need to save the planet.
Let's talk about public safety. One of the concerns of public safety is bail reform. It's a very contentious topic in New York State, especially here in Sullivan County, of course, our 19th district. What is your stance on the current laws? Do you believe changes are needed?
I come from a law enforcement family. My mom worked for 20 years as a probation officer in Tioga County before finally retiring. Through the course of my career, I've supported law enforcement. I've brought Democrats and Republicans together to provide additional funding for our law enforcement. So I come at it from that perspective. I do think we need to take a really hard look at some of the laws that are on the books, make updates to those. Look, we can and we need to find the right balance between, on the one hand, we should not criminalize poverty in this country. We should not criminalize mental illness in this country. We should not criminalize homelessness in this country. At the same time, people who are a threat, people who are a danger, need to be off the streets and not causing harm. And so, you know, I think judges need the discretion to make sure that people who are a threat are being detained appropriately. And it's something we should be constantly evaluating in conjunction with law enforcement.
Now, given the current polarization in Washington, how do you think you could approach working across the aisle, particularly issues like we talked about, you know, healthcare, housing, inflation, and infrastructure that affects the 19th congressional district?
So I'm a Democrat. I come from a Republican family. To this day, I couldn't tell you the political party of my neighbors on Bartzell Street. My next door neighbor from growing up, he helped raise us, and we were sitting on the porch, and he said the other day, "You know how it is, Josh, around here." And I'll tell you this: I know he's voting for me. I know he supports me. I don't know if he's a Democrat or Republican. He said, "You know, Josh, how it is around here. We're not really into Democrats and Republicans. We're just really angry at all of them." And I think that's kind of the sense. I think the divides in this country. Look, this is a very competitive and big congressional district, and one of the honors of my life has been traveling around and talking to people from all different backgrounds, all different walks of life, all different political views. And I'm leaving every day more inspired by who we are as upstate New Yorkers and Americans every day. And I think if the only thing you knew about our politics was what you were watching on cable news every night, you would think we were hopelessly divided. And I get to go out and talk to people, and I know that that's not the case. I think the divide in this country is not between Democrats and Republicans. I think the divide in this country is between everyday people on the one hand and the powerful special interests and the corrupt political establishment on the other. And so when I'm out talking to people on the campaign trail every day about why I think we need term limits so that we can get some new leadership in our politics, talking to people about why I don't take any corporate PAC money because I think our political system is corrupt as hell and my vote's not for sale. When I'm out talking to people about why I'm pro-choice, because I believe women can make their own healthcare decisions, why I support Social Security because you've earned it, those aren't issues that are dividing Democrats and Republicans. Those are issues where it's everyday people on the one hand and the special interests and the political establishment on the other. So that's the approach I'm going to take to this. I, coming from, as a Democrat coming from a Republican family, one of the things I learned above all else is give each other the benefit of the doubt. And you might disagree on the way to get to where you're going, but most of us want to get to the same place.
Yeah. Now, your opponent, Mark Barnardo, has really pointed out that what's happening in the southern border, what's happening with immigration at this point. He puts a lot of the blame on you. Say some of the policies, there are policies that you've done, but things you have supported in the past have really caused what's happening in the southern border. Do you have any response to that?
Well, he's wrong about all of it. He's wrong about all of it. He is the one who's been in politics for 30 years, and he is the one who's been in Congress for the last 2 years. And in the 2 years he's been in Congress, we've had over 4 million crossings at the southern border. And instead of actually doing something to solve the problem, he is just playing politics with it. There is a bipartisan bill that's supported by the Border Patrol Union, and it's sitting on his desk right now. And all he has to do is pick up a pen and write his name on it, and it would solve a lot of these problems. But he won't do that. And he won't do it because his boss, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, told him not to do it. And the reason Mike Johnson told him not to do it is because his boss, President Trump, told him not to do it. And the reason President Trump doesn't want to do it is because he wants to exploit this issue during the campaign season. It is so frustrating for so many of us to see politicians from both parties fail to do anything meaningful on this issue. So look, my plan, I've been very clear about, and my opponent can lie about it all he wants, but I've been very clear on it. I think we need physical barriers along the southern border where it makes sense to have them. We need thousands of additional border patrol agents. We need to deploy the most cutting edge technologies to stop the fentanyl trafficking. And we need the politicians to stop screwing around and get serious about solving this problem. And that includes, first and foremost, my opponent.
Why should voters vote for you over your opponent?
Look, there's some real big differences between his policies and his record and mine. He's a 30-year career politician. I support term limits. He's taken nearly $1 million in corporate PAC checks, and you can draw a direct line from the challenges that families are facing across upstate New York to the votes that he's taking in Congress. And you can draw a direct line from the votes that he's taking in Congress to the corporate PAC checks that are getting stuffed into his pockets. I'm pro-choice. I believe women can make their own healthcare decisions. And one of the first things I'm going to do when I get to Congress is sign on to the Women's Health Protection Act to put Roe v. Wade back into law. My opponent voted 13 times to restrict abortion rights. He's been anti-choice for his entire 30-year career, and he's opposed Roe v. Wade. And I'm serious about solving the crisis at the southern border. I'm serious about fixing our completely broken immigration system. And I'm really frustrated with politicians from both parties who refuse to do it. My opponent, he's had 2 years to get the job done, and he refuses to do it because he thinks it's good for his politics.
Well, we're talking to Josh Riley, Democrat Josh Riley, running for the Congressional 19th District against Mark Barnardo, Republican Mark Barnardo. Thank you so much, Josh Riley, for talking to
us. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Patrizio Rubio talking to Josh Riley, who's running against incumbent Mark Molinaro in New York's 19th Congressional District. This is definitely not the last time that you are going to hear from these two candidates here on Radio Catskill. On October 10th, mark your calendar, we're going to be bringing you a live debate between these two. That's the Decision 2024 Upstate Debate Consortium's New York 19th House District Debate, happening Thursday evening, October 10th, live right here on Radio Catskill. And before that, next up for Radio Catskills election coverage, don't miss our rebroadcast of the Catskills News and Mid-Hudson News Decision 2024 debate for the New York State 100th Assembly District. That's happening Friday morning at 11 when we're playing that. And our series of candidate interviews continues next week with New York's 51st Senate District. And next Tuesday night, this coming Tuesday night, be with us for the CBS News Vice Presidential Debate simulcast brought to us by NPR with NPR analysis afterwards. All on Radio Catskill. keeping you connected this election season. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the Delaware Aqueduct shutdown. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It's still unclear how far it's going to go. I mean, it's already gotten to be much, much bigger than it was. And now everybody is wondering what's next. Is there going to be continuous airstrikes trying to take out Hezbollah's infrastructure, military infrastructure, or is it possible that the Israelis are going to launch a ground invasion?
I'm Sabrina Tavernisi. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
If it's happening here, it's on Radio Chatskill. Local events, local voices. Live local conversations 5 days a week. Radio Chatskill. Weekday mornings at 10.
Welcome back to The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole, and now it's time for us to get the latest news from The River Reporter. And for that, we turn to The River Reporter's own Ruby Rayner, joining us once again on The Local Edition. Ruby, welcome back.
It's great to be here again.
Let's start. I hear you've got reporting about flooding risks with an imminent shutdown of the Delaware Aqueduct. Before you tell us about that, can you remind listeners what the shutdown is?
Surely. So this is an unprecedented event. The Delaware Aqueduct will be shut down for 5 to 8 months to complete vital leak repairs starting on October 1st. So it's coming up. And usually this matters because usually 600 million gallons per day of water are diverted from the upper Delaware and sent to New York City. But in order for them to be able to conduct the repairs of these leaking sections, the water diversions to the city will stop, which then results instead of them, of all that water pooling in upper Delaware reservoirs, including Papacton, Neversink, and Cannonsville. So that's the kind of background. And the repair is essential because it's been delayed, and it's also been decades-long in the making. The leaks were first discovered in the 1990s, actually. There's one beneath the Hudson River near Newburgh, and then there's another in Ulster County in the town of Lawarden. And as I said, in order to repair these leaks, there's going to have to be that diversion that usually happens won't occur, and a portions of the tunnel that connects the reservoir systems to New York City's water will be shut down. So that's what's happening on October 1st and why it is happening.
And as you said there, it's been decades in the process. It's been going on for decades and include like major construction further downstate on the lower end of the aqueduct. So now local officials are still concerned about flooding. I think this was part of the concerns last year that led to the delay. What are the concerns?
Yes, and that's correct. That has been part of why there have been delays. But basically one of the main vehicles, as I said, to divert the water just isn't there anymore. And so without that option, and whether that be for 5 to 8 months is unknown, there's this risk that the reservoirs could overflow. And there aren't the same tools that are typically there in order to avoid that from happening. And Diane Tharp, who is the executive director of the North Delaware River Watershed Conservancy, she's been working on this project for the last 18 years. She's worked with various organizations involved with the shutdown, including, you know, New York State, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and New York City Departments of Environmental Protection, who have all been involved in some capacity. And she says basically, and I'm going to quote her here, "Everyone living below the dams must remain vigilant and watch the gauges to monitor the capacities of the reservoirs throughout the closure and take action if needed." So there is still, without with this shutdown, there is still concern around flooding.
Mm-hmm. My goodness. And, you know, this is something I want to ask, and I don't know if you encountered it in your reporting, but I've been, I like to drive around on the weekends and take pictures and things like that. And in the last week, I've actually seen a couple of the local reservoirs, the Neversink Reservoir, the Papacton Reservoir. They look very low. And I knew that we had a couple of weeks there with not much rain. But have they been drawing down the reservoirs to prepare for this? That's one of the questions I had when I see how low the reservoirs are.
Yes. So there have been a couple of things that the New York City DEP has done in order to prevent, hopefully, any flooding. So one of the things that they are doing and they have been doing is drawing down those reservoirs in order to create a void. And all of them, except for Papakton, will reach the goal of a 30% void. So that's why they probably look a little lower, and that's a good thing in preparation for the shutdown on October 1st. But there's been other things in addition to this that they've requested. So in addition to that, SARP and other organizations like Friends of the Upper Delaware River have also requested that they implement these kind of temporary stiphons, which are pumps that can move water elevation as like a secondary emergency use. But the New York City DEP, the data that they used to conduct, you know, a survey in order to assess whether those stiphons were necessary showed that they weren't. And one of the issues that these organizations had was that the data that was used in that study wasn't necessarily the most up-to-date. So they were concerned that more up-to-date weather data could have, it might not have, but it could have shown that, in fact, these extra secondary emergency stiphons to remove water were in fact, necessary. But they have not implemented those stiphons, so that option is not there. The only two things that have been implemented, like you said, the reservoirs are looking a little bit lower, and they have been lowering them in preparation, and that they've met those goals in Neversink, and Papakton is close to reaching that goal, but won't. And in Papakton, they also reached that void goal of lowering it, and then they are ensuring that they will do as much releases as possible starting on October 1st and in other ways as much as they possibly can.
Okay. Finally, is there anything that folks along the river can do to prepare for this?
So Skelding from executive director of Friends of the Upper Delaware suggested sandbags for people by the river. And I'm going to read a quote here from Diane Tharp, the flood expert, which I think is, you know, addressing the issue. She says, quote, "We all pray that the aqueduct will close. Mother Nature will be kind to us with no crazy storms, and construction will go as planned and finish in 5 months rather than 8 months." And then she continued to say that everyone living below the dams must remain vigilant. But that really, in essence, at this time, it's up to Mother Nature.
Okay, we've got less than a minute before we got to go. Just wondering if you can give us an update on the possibilities of a debate for New York's 51st Senate district?
Yes. So it's seeming to be unlikely that New York voters will see the candidates for the 51st New York State Senate. The incumbent Republican Peter Oberacker and Democratic challenger Michelle Fraser. There was a debate that was supposed to be pre-recorded September 18th by Vocal Media in Liberty that did not take place. Fraser, in a press release, said that Oberacker had pulled out and that she is willing to do the debate. Representatives for Oberacker said that this debate was never on his calendar. And a campaign manager for Oberacker says that they have no debate scheduled and will consider scheduling a debate with challenger Fraser if her campaign becomes, quote, viable. Oberacker's campaign has based Fraser's campaign's viability on, they said, quote, recent internal polling. And Fraser's campaign responded to that, saying that it's the voters who decide if a candidate is viable. So that's the update there. It's unlikely that there will probably be a debate between those two candidates.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that update. And thank you for letting us know what's going on with the aqueduct shutdown. Ruby, have a great weekend when it gets here. We'll talk to you next week.
Awesome. Thanks, Jason.
That's going to do it for the local edition tonight. Thank you so much to Ruby Rayner. Thank you to both candidates from New York's 19th Congressional District for talking to us. If you missed either of those interviews, they're up at WJFFradio.org. Retro Cocktail Hour is coming up at 7, but first, we got the Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill's annual music sale is the Saturday after Thanksgiving, and we still need donations of high-quality vinyl, super clean discs, indecent jackets, collectible pop, rock, and jazz records, as well as genres that we don't often see at the sale, hip-hop, heavy metal, and experimental records. And what we need more than anything else is you, a collector who has cared for your records and would like to see them go to a good home. If you're a collector who needs to downsize, email feedback at WJFF.